Hi, it's Michael Senoff with Michael Senoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. The title of this interview is called Sometimes You Have to Jump at the Chance. It's an inspirational interview with motorcycle daredevil legend Bob Gill. I recently sent out an email to my list called Daredevil about a childhood hero of mine named Evel Knievel. He was a motorcycle legend from the 1970s and 80s. Little did I know that one of the people receiving my email would be Daredevil himself, Bob Gill. He's a fellow Daredevil motorcycle legend and former friend of Evel Knievel's. So when Bob contacted me, I jumped at the chance to interview him about his motorcycle jumping days, the sponsorships he negotiated for himself, and how he made his money, his world-famous Super Bowl commercial, and his career-ending injury. And in this two-part audio, you'll hear all about Bob and how he became one of America's most amazing daredevil motorcycle jumpers of all time. In part one, we call it the flying by the seat of his pants. Bob says he lied his way into his first motorcycle jump. He had just started hearing about a guy named Evel Knievel who was making good money jumping his motorcycle, and he decided he wanted to try and do that too. So he went to the local racetrack promoter and told them he was already jumping five cars without the use of a landing ramp. The promoter was so impressed, he asked Bob to jump at the show that weekend. Instead of admitting to the lie, Bob jumped at the chance, enlisted the help of a physics-minded friend, and figured out how to make it all work. And that was just the beginning of many opportunities for this thrill seeker. And in part one, you'll hear how Bob went from a no-name guy from Florida to the guy everyone wanted to sponsor. You'll also hear all about his early days on the road with Evel Knievel. You'll hear exactly how Bob found his many successful sponsors and what he received from each. You'll learn how Bob kept racetrack owners honest when it came to the gate counts and payments. You'll hear the win-win deal Bob's manager used to sell Bob to racetrack promoters that earn Bob the big bucks. You'll learn why Bob is worried about Robbie Knievel's next jump and what he plans to do about it. Now get ready for part one and let's get to it. I guess what I want to start with you, it's really cool that you were on my list and I sent that email out about Evel. So you wrote me back and here's what you wrote. You said, Michael, I beat all of Evel's records without the use of a landing ramp. I jumped the whole fleet of Ryder trucks for Super Bowl VIII without a landing ramp. I set the nighttime world record at Seattle International Raceway, July 17, 1973, jumping 22 cars, 171 feet, to a record crowd in the 1975 Guinness Book of World Records. They ran the Ryder commercial for 2 years in all major markets, making them number one in rental trucks. The commercial was listed as best action commercial of the year. I jumped Cajun Canyon in New Orleans in 1972 to a record distance. I had a near-fatal crash August 25, 1974, jumping a 200-foot lake, missing by 3 feet, hitting the bank at 95 miles an hour. My career ran from 1970 to 1974, jumping 165 times with only 5 crashes. Evel and I were best friends. After we both retired for over 30 years, I've known Robbie Knievel since he was a little boy. When I went to Evel's funeral in Butte, Montana, it was 10 below zero, yet 3,500 people showed up in the blowing snow. I really miss him. Now you're up to speed on Evel and I. I just thought that was so cool.
Well, cool. Congratulations.
So why'd you write me back?
Because, see, you and I had a brief conversation, and I'm sure you had no reason to remember it because I was talking about Jim Straw. And see, Jim sent me your little thing about the $20 deal several months ago. And I called you on the phone, and I asked you, I said, I'm out of town, and I have no way to pay you. And I'm going back to Butte, Montana. Could I please send you a check when I get back? And you said yes. And as soon as I got back and I turned my computer on, you sent me all the stuff, and you said, I'm just going to trust you. And I thought that was so cool that you did that. And then when that thing, when Evel came through, I thought to myself, you know what? He's went to Google, and he's typed in some stuff and looked me up and found out that Evel and I used to compete. That's what I really thought. I didn't know that you were addressing that to the world.
Yeah, I heard that you were racing cars, and you weren't making enough money.
I started racing bikes when I was 14.
And were you racing competitively for money?
Oh, yeah. I started out, naturally, as a sportsman. That was what they called it back then when it was free. You race for trophies. And then when I got to be, I think, 16, I became a novice, which is the first year of professional racing with the American Motorcycle Association. And I drove to California with my mechanic. I remember the first time I was in Iowa, and I was running down the road, probably about 65 or 70 in my van with a bunch of my friends. We were going to a race. And all of a sudden, Evel comes flying by us with this Winnebago with his flatbed trailer on it. and it says Evel Knievel on the side of it. And I went, what in the world is that? You know, I've never heard of that before. This was before he did Caesar's Palace in 69. So, you know, I'm wondering who in the world this Evel Knievel guy is. And so anyway, out in Iowa and Kansas, Missouri and all this, every once in a while he would come zinging by and he drives like Mach 10, you know. He'd be driving, I bet you, 85 or 90 mile an hour in that motorhome. And he'd go by us. And after Caesar's Palace was over with, I found out who he was. I had not a clue who Evel Knievel was. That was in 1970 is when I really got the bug to do that. So, like I said, I lived in Florida, and I came back for the winter, and I got this bug in my head. I said, you know what? I think I can do that. I really think that I can be a motorcycle jumper. I've been a TT racer, a half miler, a road racer, scrambler. I've done this all my life. So I went out to the racetrack, and I really just wanted to kind of feel my way. Sunshine Speedway in my hometown of St. Petersburg is a real big quarter-mile stock car paved track. They do figure eight in there, and they had a drag strip. And all the big names that have all been in the history have all raced there, Don Garlitz and Art Malone and, you know, all the big funny car guys and all, they've all been there. So I went out there into the racetrack, and I talked to the manager, and Joey Chitwood is a really good friend of mine. He's a big stunt car guy. He did a lot of the James Bond movies, and Chitwood used to do a lot of testing out there. So I'm out there with the racetrack promoter, and I lied to him. I said, I've been jumping cars out in the Midwest all summer long, and this is my hometown. I just wondered if I could get a shot at doing it here on your racetrack, on the quarter-mile track and the drag strip. And he says to me, he says, well, what have you been jumping? So I just pulled out a Blue Sky. I says, oh, I'm jumping five cars with no landing ramps. And he goes, wow, no landing ramp? And I says, yeah. I said, that's a little bit different than Evel Knievel, because I just started hearing about Evel Knievel.
You didn't even premeditate.
I've never done it before. I don't have any equipment for it or nothing. And I'm out there on a Monday.
What was your idea? You wanted to start this career and this was going to be a way in?
Well, a way in, but I figured that, well, maybe, you know, I can get him interested and I'll go home and build some ramps and I'll do some playing around and I'll figure out how to do this and then I'll just come out here and do it.
And he would have you when there would be an auto race?
Yeah, like a quarter mile track race on Saturday night and drag strip on Friday night. So his name's Al Lamphere. And I said to Al, I said, what do you think about that? And he said, I got an idea. And I said, what is it? He jumps up from his desk. He goes back to a desk behind him. He pulls out a drawer and throws this big book up on the top of the desk, opens it up, and he says, you know Joey Chitwood? And I go, well, yeah, I mean, I'm from here, and he's in Tampa, and he's a big stunt car guy. He does all the Bond movies. He says, yeah. He says, he's supposed to be out here Friday and Saturday nights. And by the way, this is Monday I'm talking to you. And he says, he had to cancel. He had to go out of town. Why don't we have you here Friday night on the drag strip and Saturday night on the oval track? And I go, oh, my God. I didn't want to say to him, I've never done this before, because I've already told him this big cockamamie story. So he says, how much do you charge? And I thought to myself, here's where I'm going to buy some time. I'm going to highball the sucker, and he's not going to let me do it. So I was thinking to myself, every week after racing five times a week in about a 3,000-mile loop, I used to make about, oh, I guess maybe $3,000. That's if I won the races or got in the top three. So I said to him, I says, how about $3,000? He says, done.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
At this time, you didn't have any idea about what Evel was doing or,
no.
or the... Okay, all right, keep going. This is good.
And I go home, and there's this guy that lives across the street from me, Frank Boyd. He goes to college. He's younger than me. He's studying external ballistics, which something projected at a certain angle goes a certain distance, and, you know, like you do a bullet. So I went over to him, and I said, Frank, I said, would you help me? And he says, what do you need? And I said, well, I booked a date at Sunshine Speedway Friday night, Saturday night to do a five-car jump, and I've never done it before. And I don't have a ramp. I don't have anything. I don't know what to do. And I said, could you maybe help me? He starts laughing. He says, you did what? And I said, yeah. And he says, okay. He says, we can whip up something. So him and I, we worked almost every night till midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning building ramps and doing all these crazy things and figuring out how to get the thing in my van and paint it and make it look like I've been on it before. And we took the stuff out to a place called Wheaton Island. It's out by the Florida Power Plant and set it up in a field and put some string across where five cars would be. And I went out there and jumped until I could get over that string. And all this happened from Monday afternoon until Thursday morning when Al Lamphere wanted me out there for a press conference. And he had all the media, which all the media then was ABC, NBC, and CBS. That's it.
Wait, when was the press conference? What night?
On Thursday.
Thursday. So he wanted you out there for a press conference.
Yes, yes. So I'm out there. I mean, I've made all kinds of modifications to my bike, what I think would really work suspension-wise and all. I did all my mechanic work. I used to build all my Daytona bikes. I know how to do this stuff, but I didn't know I was going to be under this kind of pressure. So we go out there on Thursday, and we set up on a drag strip, and I'd been jumping in dirt out in the field right behind the power plant. So we set the thing up, and I had never jumped over cars. I just jumped over string. So Al Lamphere brings out five cars, which are – his employees, and they park them all out there, and the media is all there, and pretty soon it looks a lot further than that string was. You know, natural things are a lot different than what jumping over air looks like. So I said to Frank, I said, does that look like it's about the right distance? So he goes out through the tape measure and measures. He says, yeah, it's right on the money. He says, it's exactly what we did at Wheaton-Allen.
How scared were you?
Oh, I was scared to death. I was petrified. So the media set all the cameras up, and the St. Pete Times was there, and the Tampa Tribune was there, and the Clearwater Sun was there, and they all got their cameras. What they wanted to do, they wanted to run it on the newspaper, run it on the TV, and, you know, he was going to buy some commercials, because the next night I was going to be jumping. So I go out there, and I make a couple speed runs by, and I'm really scared.
Were you doing wheelies?
I could wheelie real well. I mean, I did wheelies too, but the jump was what was really bothering me.
Did you have a speedometer? Did you know how fast you...
No.
Did your friend help you figure out exactly how fast you needed to be going when you hit
that? He told me how fast I needed to be going, and what we did is we geared my bike to where I could run full speed in third gear, and we clocked it as the speed that we needed to be. So that's how I calculated what I was doing, because I was riding a dirt bike. I was riding a Bull Taco 250 dirt bike.
Who made that bike?
They were made in Spain.
Okay, and that's a good bike?
Oh, it was a real good bike, and I used to use that for my quarter-mile racing, so I had it, but I had to put better suspension on it.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. So you were really the main event to sell tickets and bring people out.
Oh, yeah. I made a couple speed runs in third gear, and I said to Frank, I said, I don't feel like I'm going fast enough. I'm afraid I'm going to land in these cars. I'm going to do it in fourth gear. He says, well, he says, it's going to make a big difference. So I run up in fourth gear, and I jumped over, and I was still going up when I went past the fifth car. And when it come down, the rear tire and the front tire both blew out. The front hub cracked, and it wobbled, and, man, I landed so hard, my back was killing me. I didn't fall. No, I did not fall. I stayed on the bike. I turned it around, and I came back and stopped it, and they all come over to me with the cameras, and I was camera shy because I'd never done this before. And it made me nervous, and I tripped all over what I was saying, and it was just a terrible thing. But I did it. I pulled it off.
Was that footage in the documentary on you?
The only thing that's in the documentary is the pictures of me riding the Bull Taco on the rear wheel, and I think there's one shot in the air, but it didn't show the landing. It's at nighttime at the speedway. But this was during the daytime.
How packed was that place?
Oh, it was packed. Absolutely packed. Friday night and Saturday night, both people were hanging from rafters.
Now, would it have been as packed if you weren't jumping?
Oh, no.
How did they fill the seats before?
Friday night drag strip was always a very local thing, and maybe they would pull 800 or 1,000 people, and we pulled about 5,000 that night. The oval track, it had grandstands all on one side, and it would probably be maybe half full most Saturday nights. The place was packed. They were all lined up by the fence. The pits were full. It was unreal. I drew so well that that's where I got my start. They named me the Florida Flyer. That year, I jumped 65 or 67 times, and I made about 80 grand.
Did you start charging more after that one?
Well, yeah. Got a business manager out of South Carolina.
Okay, so you did the first jump, and then you got a little notoriety, newspaper articles. You were kind of a star right then. And then what happened after that first jump? Did your phone start ringing, or did people come to you to do stunts, or did you hustle up more business?
I actually did the hustling myself at that time. I called Tampa Dragway. They all knew, I mean, because it was on the front page of the St. Pete Times, the front page of the Tampa Tribune. I was a pretty hot ticket.
So your marketability was they bring you in, they sell more seats.
Yes, exactly.
That daredevil jumping, that was a proven winner to pack the house.
Oh, absolutely. In those days, it was real good because, see, 1970 to 74, which was my career, that was the Vietnam time. And, you know, the country was a mess. Everybody was all stressed out about it. Nixon was the president. Everything was a disaster area in the economy, except that what people did to relieve stress, they would go to entertainment events. They would go to sports events. They would go to races and stuff like that. So myself and Evil Bud, we took advantage of that because we were like the new kid on the block. That's what we were. I mean, people come out to see us just to relieve the stress. And we would pack these places, man. I mean, just completely pack them. And I wasn't making any money compared to what Evil made my first year, but it was a start.
How many years had he been doing the same thing before your first one?
What really got me off the ground was after my first year, I jumped back at Sunshine. I think I jumped Sunshine Speedway 7 times. And I think it was my second time that I was there or my third time. I can't remember for sure. Dave Rupp, who turned out to be my business manager from Palm Beach, he was up there visiting Al Lampier, and they were good friends because he had a big racetrack in West Palm Beach. It was called Palm Beach International Raceway. And Rupp ran that thing. And he said to me after I made the jump, he says, I'd sure like to have you come down there.
After your first jump?
No, this was after the second or third time I'd been to Sunshine. I had probably made, I don't know, 20, 30 jumps.
You were running the business then?
Oh, yeah.
How did you approach the business manager? Did he approach you or you approach him?
Well, he actually approached me originally at Sunshine to come down and do the jump. And after I did it down there, he had so many people come to my jump. He says, Bobby, I want to be your manager. He says, I've never done that before. He says, but, man, I got a gift to gab, and I know all the racetrack promoters everywhere in the South. And I said, well, heck yeah, man, let's do it.
And was he good at this stuff?
Oh, he was very good at it.
So when you get a manager, first of all, I'm sure it was a lot of work. You were running a business, basically.
Oh, yeah.
And so before you got your manager, were you pretty busy running this business?
Well, like I told you, my first year, I jumped 65 times.
And so you had to have a trailer, you had to have your ramps, you had to invest in building this stuff. After that first jump, were you practicing more so you knew the bike wouldn't break?
Let me tell you a little secret, Michael. I never practiced one time after I did the jump out there on Wheaton Island. Every time I jumped that motorcycle from there for 4 years later, I never jumped until I got paid. Frank figured out all my jumps for me. He could land me within 3 feet of where I was going to go. When I jumped the 22 cars in Seattle, I took a can of Kawasaki green paint. Kawasaki was my national sponsor. And I put a circle out there at 170 feet that I told the crowd, this is where I'm going to land because, you know, Evil lands anywhere. I mean, he lands somewhere within 65 feet of his landing ramp. He never had any direction. He never used a speedometer. He never used anything except like a seat of the pants jumper. And I was really proud of the fact that I knew where I was going. And I put a black rubber mark right in the center of that 3-foot circle.
It's mathematics.
Yeah, I needed to practice jump like I need a hole in the head. I told Frank, I said, if I practice jump, that's how I'm going to get hurt. You know what? I just thought of something. I just told you a story about never practicing again. I did one more time at Sunshine Speedway on an off day. I believe it was on a Thursday. The date was December the 4th. I went there with Cycle News. Cycle News is a really big motorcycle publication. Back in those days, they were in the West Coast, they were in the East, and they were in the South, and it was called Cycle News Dixie, and Dixie came down to do a feature centerfold on me, and they wanted me to go out there with their photographer and shoot some jumps, and I did, and he shot all kinds of pictures, and we're just getting ready to put everything away. He says to me, I got one more idea. He says, I would like to stoop down on one of the cars and have you go over top of me and let me get a shot of that. And we've been doing this all day, so I said, okay, no problem, I can do that. I said, I'm getting kind of sore because I've made probably 6 or 7 jumps. I'm really tired. And he said, well, this will be the last one. Well, when I went up the ramp, he stood up. And when he stood up, he had the camera, if you can imagine him holding it, in his right arm. And my footrest caught him right in the center of his right arm and broke his arm right in half.
Wow.
The camera hit the engine cases. When I hit him, I did a big flip in the air and landed upside down on my head. My Bellstar helmet broke both my collarbones. The bike bounced in the air. It came back down, handlebars in my chest, broke all my left ribs, and broke my pelvis. Now, there's nobody out there. Al Lamphere is at the office, which is probably about 3 blocks away from where we were practicing at. And I'm laying there gasping for breath because I collapsed both my lungs. The photographer is knocked out. His arm's broken. The camera split wide open. It was a 35-millimeter motor drive. All the shots we took all day long were in that camera. They all got ruined. And my wife, luckily I was married at the time, ran full speed ahead over there and got Al Lamphere. He called the ambulance. He called him and said that there's a motorcycle accident at Sunshine Speedway. Well, they knew that Sunshine wasn't running at that time of the day. They thought it was out on the road. So the ambulance came and didn't see anything and went back. And I laid on the ground, bleeding out of my mouth, gasping for air and breathing blood for 45 minutes before the ambulance got there. And Ken, the photographer, was knocked out. He still laid there. It's a wonder it didn't kill him. And they finally took us to the hospital, and they had to do what they got to do, you know, to get your lungs back going and get his arm all fixed and everything. But it was a mess. And that right then is when I said to myself, you know what, I'm never practicing again. That is it, because I made nothing for that, and I almost cost myself my career. So that's why I never did it. Even when I did big, long jumps, when I jumped the 22 cars in Seattle, that was the first time I'd ever done that.
Okay, so what kind of deal do you make with a manager? Let's say you've got good things going. You've got a manager who wants to promote you. What's the negotiation?
He got 15% of what I did.
15% of the gross?
Yes.
That's pretty fair.
Yeah.
And what was his responsibility?
Keep me busy, booking me, and then he wrote radio copy for me. He was really, really good. Being a racetrack promoter like he was at the racetrack, He wrote off his own radio copy, his own news stories. He knew how to do all that stuff. And Rupp really put me on the map.
He wrote all the copy, and then the raceways, if they wanted to promote their weekend events, they would use that copy to use you as a draw.
Yeah, we would have a press kit. And when I first started out, as I told you, I rode a Bull Taco for the first year. Then a dealer, matter of fact, I'm getting ready to go see this lady on my trip. Her name is Miss Thelma Reeves. She's 85 years old now. She has Suzuki of Greenville, South Carolina. She sponsored me from 1971 through about the end of 72. Just out of her dealership there, she gave me my bike. She gave me my parts. She didn't pay me any money. She didn't have any to pay me. But I actually called her today. I called her my South Carolina mama. She's a sweetheart. She is just the nicest lady. And I'm getting ready to go see her when I go on my trip.
All right, hold on. I just want to stop for the business people in mind. She sponsored you. What is sponsorship? What was in it for her? What was in it for you? And why does sponsorship work?
When I was riding the Bull Taco, it was all my deal. Bull Taco would not sponsor me. They would not give me bikes or parts. Mrs. Reeves, when I jumped in Greenville, South Carolina at Greenville Raceway, and she came over to me, introduced herself to me, and she said, I'm the Suzuki dealer in town, and I really like what you do. I like the image that you have with the people. I would like to supply you with the bikes that you need and the parts that you need. If you're interested, I'm available. And I told her I would love to do that. I wanted a bigger bike anyway. She wanted to put me on a 400 Suzuki, so I did.
Did you sign documents or anything?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she gave me two bikes and all the parts and whatever I needed and any type of support I needed. She was wonderful.
Okay, so for you, you got support, bikes, parts. What did they get?
They got exposure. Suzuki of Greenville. I mean, I jumped all in the South. I was the guy that jumped in Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Florida. That's where the places I was pretty much booked in my early days when she signed with me. She got a lot of exposure from it.
Do you think it directly helped her sell more bikes?
She told me it did.
People wanted Suzukis?
Yeah, she told me it did. She said she did really well with me.
And was she only selling Suzuki?
Yes.
Back at that time, it was a dealership only sold their brand.
Exactly. She was Suzuki of Greenville. That's what it was called.
All right, the first year you made 80 grand. Tell me about the second year. You had your sponsor the second year?
Well, that's when I had Suzuki and I had Dave Rupp. And Rupp, he was booking me for a lot more money at the time. And he put me on percentage deals, which I really like to do.
Tell me about that, the money part.
At the time Rupp got hold of me, I was jumping way more than five cars. I think I was jumping 12 or 13 or 14 cars, something like that.
You started with five. What was the next one?
I went from five to eight, then to 10.
And just as your confidence built, you went a little further and further.
Well, Frank helped me. I mean, he kept telling me, you know, he says, I know what I'm doing. And I believed him. You know, I had a lot of faith in him. And he said, all we got to do is increase the speed this much and the angle at this much. And, I mean, he would dial me right in. It was perfect.
The jump itself, I mean, none of them were any harder than the other, was it?
Well, yeah. I mean, without a landing ramp, you land flat on the ground. And later on in the years, as time moved on, towards the end of 1972, Kawasaki picked me up in a Kawasaki factory.
What happened with your sponsorship?
Yeah, I need to tell you that. At this point in time, I picked up some pretty good sponsors. And one of my sponsors was a company out of Michigan. It was called Diff Brake, D-I-F-F Brake. And what that did was when you would touch the rear brake, the front brake would come on. It was supposed to be a big new thing for motocross racing. Well, it was really bad for motocross because the front wheel would start sliding in the corner and the guys would go down. And it wasn't really great. So the guy that owned the company, his name was Russ Shreve. He said to me, he says, you know, I'm having some problems with motocross, and he said, I'm getting some negative input on it, but I'm doing some research and development trying to get it fixed. He said, I would like to sponsor you, and I said, well, what would you like to do for me, Russ? I was running around in the van at the time. He said, I'll buy you a brand new motorhome, whatever one you want. He says, well, Winnebago was one of the top ones back then, you know. I says, okay, I'd like to have a Winnebago, 27-foot, really nice, blah, blah, blah. I told him all the things I wanted on it, and two or three weeks later, he showed up in Dalton, Georgia, where I was at jumping with the motorhome at 2 o'clock in the morning with a great big ribbon wrapped around it.
Okay, so what did you have to do with that sponsor? You had to use his diff brakes?
Yeah, I used his diff brake, which worked great for me because then I wouldn't have to take my hands off the handlebars to pull the front brake in to get stopped.
Oh, I see. Did you have to wear his logo on your helmet?
Put his logo on the motorhome, naturally, because that's what he supplied me with. And I had it also on my bike. And he used to buy full-page ads every single week in Cycle News. Every single week.
And you were his main sponsor.
I was a big deal for him. And I made him a lot of money. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I made Russ a lot of money.
And so it was just a no percentage deal on what you made him. It was just he gave you the motorhome, you advertised, and
he advertised me. I mean, he made me money because he put me out in front of the world.
At that time, you had Kawasaki?
I had just signed with Kawasaki, and how that happened was, to tell you how I broke my relationship off with Miss Reed. I was riding on my way to Salt Lake City. I was probably, I don't know, maybe 200 miles away from Salt Lake City. I'll never forget this. And while my Winnebago was in California, Rush Street, he said, I can't ever reach you. He says, I'm going to put a phone in your motorhome. Well, back in those days, in order to put a phone in a vehicle, the contraption that ran the phone was as big as a bed. They had to take my bed out of the motorhome, put this thing under the bed, put the bed back on, run the wires all the front. It was like a glorified CB radio. It had 16 channels on it, and you would have to look at whichever one was open, you know, so you could dial out. This thing cost like 10 grand to put in the motorhome, and Russ paid it. So now I have this thing. So I'm on my way to Salt Lake City. I'm about 200 miles out, and my phone rings, and I'll never forget this. And I pick it up, and I go, hello, and the guy on the other end, he says, Bob Gill, and I said, yeah. He says, this is Don Wiggle. And I said, Don Wiggle, that sounds really familiar. He says, yeah. He says, I was the Suzuki rep back in Portland, Oregon, 1964. He says, when you were racing out there. And I says, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember you. And he says, well, I'm Kawasaki's national sales manager now. He says, I know all about you. And I go, wow, that's really cool. I said, what do you want to do? He says, well, where are you? I says, well, I'm on my way to Salt Lake City.
How old are you right now?
26. So he says, when you get to Salt Lake City, he says, you just stop that thing and get on an airplane and fly to L.A. Call me back. Tell me what flight you're on. He says, I'm going to pick you up at the airport. So I said, okay, that sounds cool. So I got on an airplane, flew to L.A., and I'm not kidding you, he laid a deal on me that was off the hook. And I don't know whether I should say this.
Yeah, just say it. He wanted you bad.
Oh, he wanted me real bad. And the fun part about it was, even though he was a Suzuki rep and I was riding factory Honda back then, him and I got to be really good friends. We really hit it off real well in the pits together, and we hung out and all. But I hadn't seen him in many, many years. So he gets me there, and he cuts me this big contract deal. And he says also, he says, I listened to you on the media, and he said, you really sound good. He says, I like the way you say, and you don't sound like you're reading it, and you don't have the hems and haws and all the things, kind of like what you were talking about. He said, I'm going to give you a really, really good incentive. And I said, like, what's that? He says, every time that you mention Kawasaki in electronic media or in the printed media, which meaning TV or radio or newspaper, magazine, he said, I'm going to give you $100 for every time that you say that. This was 1973. And I said, you're kidding. He says, no. And I says, well, you have never heard Kawasaki mentioned so much. I said, I'm not going to do something stupid like, oh, Kawasaki, Kawasaki, Kawasaki. But Frank and I, we practiced it riding down the road. He'd ask me questions, and he'd ask me every imaginable question you could think of, and I'd always have an answer with Kawasaki in it. They'd say, well, you know, what kind of bike do you ride? I says, well, I ride a factory Kawasaki. And they'd say, well, how come you ride that? And I says, well, Kawasaki Motor Corporation in Japan, not only do they make Kawasaki motorcycles, but they make Kawasaki ships, airplanes, they make Kawasaki everything. And pretty soon my checks were like 10 grand a week.
Wow, and he didn't care.
No, because the money was coming from Kawasaki Industries. See, Kawasaki Motorcycle Corporation is just a subsidiary of the big, huge Japanese corporation. They don't even really care whether they make money or not with Kawasaki Motor Corporation.
Now, you mentioned Suzuki. Is that right?
Yeah.
Was Kawasaki under Suzuki?
No. Don Wiggle used to be a road rep Suzuki before. He switched over to Kawasaki. He worked his way all the way up through the ranks. He managed a Kawasaki store, and then he went to be a district manager. Then he became an area manager, and he handled that whole big East Coast thing in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, Kawasaki East.
Besides $100 every time you said it, what else is part of your deal?
Thousands of dollars.
Let's say someone's listening and they want to negotiate a sponsorship, and like you've given a great idea, maybe that every time you mention the brand, they pay you a certain amount of money. That's something you can put into an agreement, and that's probably something a lot of sponsors offer their people, right?
I've never heard anybody ever get that before, because like going to Evil Days every year, you know, I talk to all the jumper guys, and the sponsors are not anywhere near as gracious as they were with me. I mean, they weren't even close. These guys paid me money like it was going out of style. It was insane. They loved me. They would have me go around to all the motorcycle shows and go in and sign autographs, and they would advertise me and put me on the marquee.
Was there money in that?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me where the money is with sponsorship. So just don't tell me how much, but where else can you earn income? You're the star. You're packing these stadiums. You're making these sponsorships money. I mean, the attention's on you. And show me the money. Where's the money? So if you went and negotiated a sponsorship today, learning everything you know in the past, what are you going to ask for?
In today's world?
Tell me how your deal was back then, and then maybe we can talk about in today's world.
Let me tell you the way the Kawasaki thing went down. I didn't negotiate the deal. They offered me a deal that I couldn't turn down. And they had no idea what I was getting with Suzuki. They had not a clue where I was coming from with that. And they just shot a big number at me. And I go, well, Don, yeah, I'm very interested in that. And I said, and what kind of support am I going to have with the bikes and all? He says, man, I'll give you carte blanche to anything that you want in this country. Go buy any distributorship and sign your name. Pick up any bikes you want, new bikes in a box. You want to give them away at the jumps, we can do that. Any type you want, parts, you want a bike to ride on the street, I don't care what you want, man. You just sign your name and everybody will know who you are.
Was your manager still in on this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but he didn't negotiate this deal for me. I did it on my own.
All right, and that was cool with him?
Yeah, it was cool with him.
He still got 15%, right?
Well, yeah.
Right. Did you travel with your manager?
He traveled with me if I needed him. He was, like, on call. He lived right at the airport in Palm Beach, and if I needed him for anything, like, when I did that canyon jump in New Orleans, I had a problem with the media. They didn't really want to give me any coverage, and I couldn't figure out why, and I called Rupp up, and he said, well, I'll be right there. He went to the airport and got a plane to New Orleans, and he went with me to the media, and I learned so much from him. It's unreal. I was very naive back then. I mean, I couldn't even talk to you like I'm talking to you now. I knew nothing about what I was doing.
Did your wife travel with you?
Sometimes.
So you're mainly on your own?
Yeah, pretty much on my own.
All right, so we're talking about how the deal went down. You got anything you wanted. You got $100 for every time you said Kawasaki. What else?
I got a big chunk of money in the beginning as a signing bonus. And if I wouldn't have got hurt, it would have been gigantic. But let me tell you why they fell in love with me. When I did the 22-car jump in Seattle, the United States Navy came over to me, one of their commanding officers, and there was only Bill Muncy, the ocean racer guy, Don Garlis, the big superstar drag racer guy, and they were the only two that the United States Navy was sponsoring. And they came up to me and they said, we really like what you do. And my whole thing was fly with me. That's what I used to put on the back of my helmet. And they said, we would like to put Fly Navy on the back of your helmet. And I thought to myself, you know, this is going to be a huge credibility thing. Now, one thing about the Navy back then, it wasn't a money deal. They didn't have any money allocated from Congress like they do now. Now they have like about $20 million a year that they can play with. But back then, it was totally credibility. It was like to be sponsored by the United States Navy was like an honor. Kawasaki being married to me with that happening was unreal. So one thing the Navy wanted me to do, they wanted me to go around to colleges and high schools and talk to the kids in high school and college about my career and do safety classes. Kawasaki got involved with that. They gave me a safety film up for that was like 15 minutes long. And I'll tell you exactly how the thing would go down. They would have all the kids in the auditorium. The United States Navy would go out there with their flag to dress real well, and they would stand in the front, and one of them would introduce me. And they would say, we'd like to introduce Bob Gill, the world champion motorcycle jumper, blah, 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 whatever they'd say. And he wants to talk to you and tell you about motorcycle safety. And they would bring me out, and I would start talking. I never once, and they didn't want me to, never one time did I say anything about you guys need to join the Navy. The Navy's really cool. I never said that once. They stood next to me with their uniforms on.
It was implied.
It was implied. So I travel around the country, and I'm doing these things. I went to Shriners hospitals. I even went to some prisons and did this. I mean, we did things that no one in the motorcycle jumping world ever did. I mean, Evil never did nothing like that. I mean, Evil was all about money. If you didn't pay him, he didn't want to do it. But I could see down the road that this was an association that was to be made in heaven. And it was really good.
With the Navy, you agreed to it. Same thing. You had to sign paperwork with them and all that?
Paperwork with them. And they would have their recruiters at all my jumps. And they would just stand around and look really cool and hand out literature and all. But let me tell you the good news about the whole thing. After a year went by, I got a letter from Admiral Tidd. Admiral Tidd was the admiral in charge of recruiting. And he said to me, he says, Bob, I am so proud to have you part of the team with Don Garlis and Bill Muncy. He says, we're having a big meeting up here in Washington, D.C., and we want you to be here. We want to fly you and your wife in. We got some really neat things we want to talk to you about. So I thought, oh, wow, you know, this is really cool. I'm really making points. I must be doing something right. So they fly us to Washington. We go in there, and four of the Blue Angels were there. Garlis was there. Muncy was there. Admiral Tidd and myself and Jan, my girl. So he gave me a plaque. He says, I want to tell you, he says, every city that you went into, every major market you went into, you pulled more people into the Navy than all our recruiters combined. He said, nobody has ever recruited as many people as you have recruited. And he says, how did you do that? I said, I didn't do anything. I didn't say anything about it. I just brought the Navy along. Because evidently he was in the dark about it. And I said, no. I said, that was the game plan. I said, it's supposed to be an association only. So Kawasaki got a lot of miles out of it because we're showing Kawasaki films to kids that are in high school, kids that are in college, and the Navy got the recruiting that they wanted. They gave me this beautiful plaque.
So For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. All right, I got a question. You're already entrenched with Kawasaki.
Right.
Navy approaches you. How do you handle that? Do you think maybe Kawasaki may not be into this? Or are you scared to say something? I mean, where's the limit? I mean, obviously a sports figure wants as many endorsements and deals as possible, but do you have to think about your other endorsement partners?
You want to make sure you're not dealing with any conflicting situations.
So it's all got to be non-competing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like if you went with Honda, that won't work. But Kawasaki looked at it as a benefit because Kawasaki could ride on that credibility too.
Absolutely. The sponsors that I had were non-competitive with anybody. After a while, I got Winnebago Industries. I told you that Rush Street bought me my first one. But Winnebago jumped right on the bandwagon. They gave me a brand new coach that was absolutely off the hook. So I had Winnebago. I had Valvoline Motor Oil.
Let's go through these. How'd you get Valvoline?
Valvoline came to me.
What did they say? We like what you're doing. We want...
Well, let me tell you what. That is a deal that I lost that you have no idea how much money I had to make. They originally brought me in for product and exposure only. That means that they would make up brochures and flyers and big pictures to sell and have their name on it. And they would do all the printing for me, and I would get all the money. And I used to sell Valvoline stuff with my name on it, you know, all over the place and made really good money with it.
You made royalties.
Yeah, I made kind of like royalties.
So if your face or your brand was on their product, you made a royalty on those sales.
Exactly.
And your manager helped you handle all this?
Well, really and truly, Ruff was my booking agent more than he was my manager in that respect. I actually handled all the big deals that I got. I did them myself.
Was it hard?
No. They came to me. I didn't go to anybody. Everybody I got came to me. And that makes it a whole lot easier, as you very well know. And let me tell you the deal in the end. 3 weeks before I got hurt at Appalachian Lake, they said, we want you to come to Ashland, Kentucky. We have a really good proposition we want to make to you and see what you think about it. Well, I was in the middle of the promotion of Appalachia Lake, so I took a day off, and we went to Ashland, because I was in West Virginia, and Ashland, Kentucky is not that far. So we went, and I sat down with them, and they said, here's what we want to do. We want to put your picture on every can of oil that is produced by Valvoline Motor Oil for 5 years that goes around the world, and we're going to give you a nickel a can.
Wow.
That's millions of dollars. They had all the artist conceptions of them. They wanted me to choose the can, the one that I liked the best.
And they showed them to you?
Yeah.
Do you have pictures of those?
No.
Were you married?
Well, no.
But your girlfriend?
Yeah, my girlfriend. But the media wanted her to be married, and everybody else didn't want to think that we were married because that was the thing to do back in the 70s, you know.
So, how was she feeling about all this?
Oh, she was wonderful. This girl was smart as a whip. She came from Detroit, Michigan. She'd been to finishing school, been through college. She was a model for Chrysler at the time I met her. I met her because I was jumping from Chrysler to Detroit. But anyway, she traveled me everywhere, and they loved her. Her name was Jan. She was beautiful. She was a little Italian girl. She was blonde and had blue-eyed. Her dad was Sicilian. Her mom was Roman. And she was smart as a whip. And she just was a classy chick to have along with you. Everybody loved her. The media loved her. Kawasaki loved her. The Navy loved her. Everybody.
So as far as everyone knew, she was your wife?
Yeah.
Did you have kids?
Oh, yeah. I have kids, but after my accident.
After your accident. Okay.
Actually, I have my son, Bobby. He's 38. I had him in my early years. But my other three, I had them afterwards.
Okay, Valvoline. So a nickel a can, and that was going to be a deal. You picked one of the cans.
Yeah, I picked the can, but I hadn't signed the deal yet. I told him, I said, you know what? I don't have time to go through all this thing. For something this big, I should really bring Rupp involved in it. And, you know, we'd probably get my attorney. I had an attorney in Jacksonville, Harold Hamowitz.
At what point did you have to get an attorney?
I mean, that's what I thought. You know, I thought, this is too big for me just to do. I need more advice. So I told him, I said, well, after Appalachia Lake is over, I'll be back, and we'll make this deal happen. I said, I'm excited about it. So I felt real good about it, and they felt good about it, and they weren't worried about me bringing an attorney in, as they would probably have attorneys, too, for a deal that size. It'd been millions of dollars.
What'd the can look like, the one you picked?
Well, I mean, it was a Valvoline can, and it had different pictures of me jumping. You know, it had a picture of my face, and they had a picture, one of them, like, when I was doing the Ryder commercial, and another one, I believe it was the 22-car jump or the canyon jump. But anyway, they all had different pictures on it, and I told them I want face recognition, and that's the one I wanted.
That was smart. You wanted the one that showed your face.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, it was actually, and I still have it, I'm sitting on my Kawasaki at the Ryder commercial, and the Ryder trucks are behind me, and you can see me. I'm very notable. And I think, if I remember right, the picture I have, I think it even has Valvoline on my jacket, I think.
So what we were doing is going through your sponsors. Before we get to the Ryder deal, what other stuff was happening? Valvoline?
We had Winnebago. Winnebago was interested only in Winnebago's with my name on the side. There was no money in that deal.
All right. You had Kawasaki.
Kawasaki was a money deal.
You had Navy.
Navy was a credibility thing. Valvoline was product, an endorsement thing, and they would print all my stuff. I'd made money on that.
All right, first of all, before we get to the next one, just tell me what happened with the lady who had the dealership.
I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a tearjerker. After I went to L.A. and I decided I'm going to do that, I started thinking that night in the hotel. I said, you know what, Miss Reeves, she's like my mom, and she loves me. She really does. And how am I going to tell her this? So I called her up on the phone, and I said, Miss Reeves, I said, I got really a big, gigantic personal issue that I need to talk to you about. I said, would you mind if I flew to Greenville and you just pick me up? And she says, oh, honey, you know, she talks to me like, oh, Bobby, I love you, whatever it could be, you know, I'll get a hotel for you, and I'll come get you. Okay, so I fly out, and we go to dinner, and I told her, I said, Miss Reeves, I said, that's why I would call her Miss Reeves. I said, I just was in California, and I was offered a gigantic deal with Kawasaki Motor Corporation. And she says, well, tell me about it. And I told her that. She says, you know, I've been trying to get Suzuki to do the same thing, and they just don't seem to, like, they have any vision to do that. And she got up from the table. She came around the other side. She put her arms around me, gave me a big kiss. She says, I'm so proud of you.
She said, do it.
She said, do it. She said, I gave them the chance. But they're the loser, not you. Says, I love all the things. And the couple years before I got hurt, that I rode Kawasaki, she had my jump bikes in her Suzuki Greenville on a revolving Lazy Susan type thing on a motor with a light on it and all the pictures and all this stuff. And she was so proud of that. And she would tell people, they'd ask her what happened to me. And that, oh, he signed with Kawasaki, got for a bunch of money with them. She would tell them that Suzuki didn't want to pay him any money. She's just dead honest.
She really cared about you.
Yeah, she really did. And still does. She's like my second mom. I mean, she's just a wonderful, wonderful lady, and I can't wait to see her in Greenville when I go there.
Okay, back to the other sponsors. Well, what else was going on before your accident?
The other ones are not real big. I had Bell Helmets.
But Bell's big now.
But they weren't gigantic then. They didn't have a lot of money back then. They do now.
So what'd they do?
Helmets. You know, helmets, and they would print me some things and a little publicity once in a while. Nothing gigantic. It was fine. Back then, Bellstar helmets were less than $100. The deal was worth probably maybe $300 or $400, maybe $500. But I wore them because I had always worn them in my racing career. They're the best helmet on the planet, and I wanted a Bell helmet. And I went to them and asked them. They said, we'll give you helmets. And then Bates Leathers, they're still around. Bates in Southern California. They're in the L.A. area. They never gave me money, but they gave me, I mean, leathers back then, I think were around $600 for custom leathers. They're now about $3,000, I think.
Wow, and that's pants, jacket.
Yeah, pants and jacket, and that's basically it, but really nice done. And I had my name on the legs and Kawasaki on the sides, and Kawasaki loved it, and it was green and white, and it looked really, really nice.
Let's say you wreck on the pavement. Will those things hold up to the pavement?
Oh, yeah.
And that's the whole point of those.
Yeah, that's the whole idea.
Do they have any padding in there?
Well, yeah, but you know what? That's not the good idea. What happens is they put that nylon, like, liner inside and the paddings and everything. And when you slide on the pavement, the heat that the leather generates makes the nylon burn into your skin. And it sticks to you. That happened to me in Memphis when I fell. That one picture that you see where my front wheel collapses and I go down and slide, that took all the skin off my left arm. And it was all because that leather got so hot it melted that nylon.
Did they know that?
Well, I told them, and I told them, I said, from now on out, I don't want any liners in them. I just want leather. That was something that we had all learned together. But Bates, to me, they were like a real nice family company, and anytime I needed anything, like if you notice, my leathers had fringe on the back, and my fans used to like to yank the fringe off. Girls would like to take a piece of fringe home with them. So they were constantly yanking my fringe off. I had three sets of leathers, and I would always have one set in transit to Bates, and they would put the new fringe on and ship them back to whatever hotel I was going to be at, you know, the next location. And then I gave them a really big shot, them and Kawasaki both. They asked me to do To Tell the Truth. Remember that show?
Yes.
I did To Tell the Truth. Actually, I did that the weekend that the Navy had me in Washington. I went to New York and did that show before I went to Washington.
That was in 74?
That was in 74. Two other guys that they picked out wore my leathers, and Kawasaki got a big blast out of it, and Bates got a blast.
So it's I'm Bob Gill, Motorcycle Daredevil.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really cool. So that's in 74. So things are really rocking from 70 to 74. What's going on with Evil and other jumpers? I remember in the documentary of the BBC, there was the girl jumper. What was her name?
Debbie Lawler. She's a real good friend of mine.
Was it Debbie Lawler?
Debbie Lawler. She was the Flying Angel.
Yeah, the Flying Angel.
Yeah. She jumped in the Houston Astrodome and beat Evil's record. And Evil made a comment. He says, oh, that was a big deal. He says, I can spit further than she can jump. And man, did that get some press when he said that. He ended up apologizing to her, bought her a pink mink coat, and flew her to Seattle to give it to her in front of the press.
Wow. So just talk about, from a marketing standpoint, this whole sponsorship. I mean, this sponsorship is what makes all this go around, right?
Yeah, right.
Without sponsors, you think any of this could have been possible?
Well, I mean, if I would have never had one sponsor and the money that I was able to make as a motorcycle jumper after Rupp came on the picture, I could have made it okay. I mean, the money was great. We used to get $5,000 guarantees against $2 a head and have a capability of drawing 20,000 people.
Oh, okay. So he was starting to negotiate different deals rather than a flat fee for a jump.
Yeah, well, we experimented with it. And we experimented with the guarantee against the gate count. Then the promoters started screwing you on the gate count, you know. And then we'd have to hire bonded counters to count the counters. And that was before they had ticket stalls like they have now, all computerized and all, you know, with people handing subs out, you know.
So they'd cheat you on the gate count.
Yeah, they cheat you all the time.
And you couldn't control it.
And we controlled it by having that. I would get to a point, like if I did a big jump and I got one guy, he got me for 3,000 people.
And you were supposed to make how much on each person?
$2, like an extra $6,000. So I said to him, I said, I know you don't know this. I said, but I hired bonded counter guys to count your guys as they're coming in, and I brought them in with me. And I said, our numbers are 3,000 off. And I said, it's amazing that it happens to be exactly 3,000 off. I said, so you guys are lying, and these guys are bonded. Your guys are just people that work here. And we had a big confrontation about that, and pretty soon he ended up saying, well, yeah, you know, blah, 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 some contrimining answer. And he ended up giving me the extra money, paid me the whole thing, because, I mean, I would have really ripped him apart in the press, and he knew the kind of power I had in the press.
Did this happen at other places?
Yes. But not many times, because people started catching on. They started realizing that I knew what I was doing. But it got better than that. And here's how it got better. We would go into the racetrack promoter, or Rupp would call him on the phone and say, you know, we want to bring Bob into your place, and we offer a really good opportunity for you to make, you know, a lot more money than you normally make. And he'd say to him, how many people have you had on the best day you ever had? Like when you had a big funny car race or big drag race or whatever. Because I jumped at mostly track strips in my last couple of years and NHRA tracks. The fitness promoter would say, okay, the biggest day we had was 18,822 people. The rep would say, I'll tell you what. He said, you pay Bob's expenses there, like $2,500, and put him up in a hotel, Holiday Inn or better, and anything over 18,000 people, we get half the gate. And the guy would go, well, you know, that's not a bad deal.
How much was the gate?
The gate was $10. That was a pretty much normal thing for back then. 10, maybe 15 at a real big national championship funny car race or something. But $10 to $15. So that would give him a really good deal, because if only 18,000 people come, all he's in for me is $2,500 and a lot of exposure. If 30,000 people come, he's got half the ticket gate that he wouldn't have had without me being there. And also, I make way more money by doing it that way. So that was the idea that we pretty much had towards the end before I got hurt.
Did you do any of those deals?
Oh, yeah. Not many.
Did you bring your own counters in, bonded counters?
Oh, absolutely.
That was part of the deal.
Always, always bring the money. And let them know up front, these guys are going to be counting you. So, you know, we're not going to play any games. This thing is for us all to make money. It's a win-win situation.
When do you get the money?
Right after the jump.
After the jump, you go up into the office and they give you the money?
Absolutely.
They pay you cash or checks?
Cash.
Wow.
Then, not now. When I jumped in Seattle, I jumped in front of, I think it was about 23,000 people, and they paid me in cash. And they paid me in 10s and 20s and 50s and stuff like that. It was a grocery bag full of money. And I had broke both my molars on both sides when my chin hit the tachometer, because the bike was a little bit too high in the front when the front wheel slammed down. If you watch the film, you see my chin go into the tachometer. I bit and teeth out, man, and I'm bleeding, and it's a mess. I actually stayed till 4 o'clock in the morning signing autographs and rinsing my mouth out with champagne and stuff just to make the pain go away. But we had to go to Detroit after that, Jan and I did. And we had to take a plane the next day. Well, I changed the flight time. I went to the dentist in the morning, and he took all the bone pieces out and everything. And I didn't know nothing at all about what dry socket meant. I had no idea what that means. And that means, you know, you're not supposed to suck all the juice out of it. Well, we're flying in the airplane, and my mouth is killing me, and I'm sucking and sucking, getting this stuff out, and I have to drink more and more alcohol. And it got to be, when I got there, I was pretty much loaded. But the funny part about it was when we got on the airplane, that's when they first started security. Security checks was in 74. And, I mean, it wasn't near as elaborate as it is now. You went up this counter, and you're supposed to, you know, take your wallet out and your keys out and let them see what you got. And they didn't have any machines you had to walk through. They just did visual look at you. So Jan's got this grocery bag full of money, $47,000. And it's all wadded up, and she's got it in her hand, and she's a gorgeous little girl, and she's got this great big purse on her shoulder. And this guy's a black guy, and he's standing behind the counter. And I set my wallet and stuff up there, and she sets her grocery bag up there, her purse, and he goes to the purse. And he looks all through it, and he hands it back to her. And then he undoes the grocery bag and looks down in there. And he looks at her, and he looks at the bag. Look, they must have did that about 10 times.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And he wads the thing back up and hands it to her and says, have a good day.
Oh, my God. You wouldn't do that today.
Oh, my God. They would take you in the back room and ask you where you got that, what kind of drug money is this, a billion things. But that was the funniest of all. I mean, I just about died laughing. It was hilarious. This guy was so serious, and I thought he's going to blow the whistle, man. This is over. Of course, I could have counted for the money because I was leaving out of Seattle, you know.
But, okay, so what's going on in the jumping industry with the other jumpers? What are you hearing about Evil? What are you hearing about Debbie Lawler? Who else?
Well, Debbie Lawler was no threat to me at all because I didn't compete against Debbie Lawler. I competed against Evel Knievel. That's who my game was, and that's who the press compared me with. They always compared me with Evel. They never once mentioned Super Joe Einhorn from Oakland, California. He would never came in the picture.
Was he doing jumps,
he
too?
He was a ramp-to-ramp jumper like Evel. He was a big druggy guy, and all his crew was a bunch of drug heads.
Were you clean? Were you doing any drugs?
No, I was clean as a whistle. I was the guy with the white hat.
You didn't drink?
I didn't drink. I mean, I had
a little champagne or a beer.
I never got drunk and never did crazy stuff.
And that's probably why a lot of the sponsors liked you.
That's why they came to me. I was like the kid next door. That's what they told me. Kawasaki, they absolutely fell in love with me, and them and the Navy both. They had plans for me. If I wouldn't have got hurt, I would still be on their payroll.
Why were you competing against Evel?
Because he was the only kid on the block that was giving me any competition. I used to jump further every week than Evel ever jumped in his life. I used to do 19 cars as a standard jump, and it was about 170 feet. And Evel used to claim 150, 140 feet, and in all reality, it was about 130, 135.
He wasn't competing. He just wanted the money.
Oh, Evel was all about money. He didn't care the kind of bikes he rode. He didn't care where they went through the air straight. I was a real fanatic about that. Kawasaki, when they signed with me, not only did they give me all that money, they flew their engineers over from Japan that built airplanes. And they set me up at Irwindale Raceway in California. And we jumped their standard bikes, and every time the thing would land and hit the ground, they would stretch. They would grow. They'd grow 2 to 3 inches in length. My Suzuki used to do the same thing because the technology wasn't there. They were using mild steel, and they weren't using chromoly tubing and stuff. So Kawasaki shot all this high-speed film, and they took all that data back to Japan. And when they came out with a bike for me, I mean to tell you, that thing, you could ride it off a cliff. Oh, one more sponsor I had, S&W Shocks. It was not a money deal. It was just a product deal. But I really wanted them because they were the best, and Tim Whittem was the W in S&W. He's dead now. He was an old man at that time. And he used to have his R&D department in the bottom of his house in Pasadena. And every time I came to town, he used to go in there, and he would build me special shocks that were progressive dampening. You know what that means?
Well,
because back in those days, we only had 3 inches of travel. That's all the shocks that we had. We'd have 4 inches in the front and 3 in the back. Today, they got 14 in the back and 12 in the front. So you can see there's a lot of difference. So what he had to do was he designed a thing called progressive damping, meaning that every time the plunger went down, that it would get tougher and tougher as it went down. It didn't stay the same. And the spring rate would not overload the dampening so that you would get a kabong, you know, bounce. So when I landed, he would not bounce. It would stay flat, stay stuck to the ground because of that progressive damping. Even in today's world, believe it or not, Michael, they don't have that. The guys, I watch them all the time. They hit the landing ramps and they bounce. The guys that do the dirt pile stuff, the real big high jumps, like Robbie Madison did in Las Vegas on New Year's Eve, I think 2 or 3 years ago, those things bounce all over the place because the spring rate overrides the dampening.
It looks like that's what happened on Evel's Wimpley jump.
Well, no, what happened on the Wimpley jump, and I'll tell you exactly what it is. I'm really worried about Robbie. Matter of fact, I'm going to go to South Carolina.
Robbie Knievel?
Yeah, I'm going to go see Robbie on my trip.
Why? What's he getting ready to do?
He's going to jump at Wimpley. He's going to do the same jump as Dad did, but he's going to add 3 buses. He's going to jump 16 instead of 13.
When?
June the 12th, I think. And it's going to be a multi-million dollar deal. But he wants to use the Harley just like his dad did. Now, I'll tell you why that's a bad deal, and I'll tell you why Evel didn't care. Evel didn't care the bikes he jumped because he was interested in the money that they paid him. He could care less about the other. He always felt like he could make it work. Well, what a Harley XR does, the XR is the version that they use for half-mile and mile dirt track racing. Being a dirt track racer, I know this. So coming off the corner, you want to have the engine back so the weight is on the rear wheel, so you get that good bike coming off the corner. Well, that's all good and dandy for half-mile racing, but it's not worth a hoot for jumping through the air. Because just picture this. If you had a bow and arrow, and you took the arrow and turned it around backwards and shot it, do you think maybe that the front end would start turning around and go forward, or do you think it would just go straight? Well, it's going to start turning around because the heavy end wants to pass the light end. Well, a Harley XR, it has a tendency, because of the way the engine turns and the gyro effect you get from it, the bike wants to turn to the right. The rear wheel wants to come around to the right. And that's called yaw. Like if you're flying, that would be your yaw. So you have no control over yaw. You got control over attitude up and down. You can tap the front brake, tap the rear brake, and get the front wheel to come down or up. That's real maneuverable in the air. But you can't control yaw. So Evil, when he would leave on that Harley, he would actually start to fall when he left the takeoff ramp. The thing's starting to yaw around to the right. It comes down on the landing ramp on an angle, and it pitches him over the handlebars because the rear wheel is to the right. It throws him over and chases him down the ramp and runs over him from time to time like it did at Caesar's Palace. And that's what's wrong with that type of thing. So Robbie's going to do an XR jump three buses further than his dad could get it across, and he doesn't seem to get it because he's been riding a Honda for so many years that that's what's going to happen.
And who's his sponsor, Harley?
Well, Harley will probably sponsor it, yeah, more than likely. But he needs to make that swing arm longer. I'm going to help him if he'll want to.
Well, have you told him of your concern?
Yes. I'm going to go there live on my trip, and I'm going to sit down with him and his manager and tell him that Robbie's going to make millions of dollars on his jump. He's not going to live to get through it. And that's the truth. He's not going to make it. He needs to make these changes on this bike. And if he listens to me, that'll be great, and I don't want a dime from it. I'm not asking for any money. I'm just really concerned about him. I've known him since a little boy, and his dad and I were just great friends for 30 years. Why do I want his son to get killed? And I have the knowledge. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back, but I know how to do that stuff. So I want to help him with that. You know, if he doesn't listen to me and he gets killed myself, I feel relieved. I feel like I know the answer, and if I don't share it with him, he gets killed.
Yeah, you got to share it with him, and at least you did the best you could. Okay, so why wouldn't he go further? He didn't care about the record, or he just wanted the money. That's where we got off on the subject.
It was about the money and the fact that Evil, really and truly, when you're as popular as Evel Knievel was, you can showcase yourself and make a lot of money. You know what I mean by that? You don't have to go out and do records. You just kind of have to be there and do it. Because he was the first. I mean, you got to give him the credit. And the name, and he really knew how to promote. He was a big mouth, and he really got the press, and he got tremendous publicity. So Evil knew how to play the game.
Did he have a good team, a good marketing team, or was he doing most of that?
No, he did most of it himself. He never really was into that. He thought that he could do anything and everything. I'm sure that he had some help from time to time.
Tell me about the insurance. How did you insure yourself? Who insured you for these jumps?
I never had any personal medical insurance, but I did have insurance at NHRA Drag Strip. I was the only one that had a competition license. They wouldn't even let Evil have one. They said he fell down too much.
What's a competition license? A
competition license is being to compete as an exhibitionist on an NHRA track.
All right, so if you did your jump and you were hurt, the insurance covered it?
I didn't get hurt on an NHRA track. I got hurt at a lake.
No, but if you did get hurt on one of your
jumps, I would have been insured, yes. Mm-hmm. I'd had medical insurance. I never broke a fingernail on an NHRA track.
So your sponsors couldn't offer insurance?
They probably could have, but you know what? I never even really was concerned.
You didn't worry about it?
No, I wasn't concerned about that. You know, when you're young and doing that kind of stuff, making that kind of money, you think you can do it forever. And you don't think things are going to happen bad.
All right, tell me about the Ryder commercial. How did that happen?
Okay, this is really good.
Please continue to part two.